willing to trust him, and the more you'll be wanting to obey him. So Moses introduces them to God and the kind of God that they have. That's the first entree. The rest of the book of Genesis, from chapter 2 right through to chapter 50, contains 10 stories. Each story is introduced with the phrase, this is a record of what happened to. It occurs 10 times, and it's the clue to understanding the outline of the book of Genesis. There are 10 major stories. One of the threads that tie together those 10 stories is the first entree, the character of God. And so as you read through all of the stories of the book of Genesis, the first thing any thoughtful reader does is ask themselves, what is Moses teaching this young generation about their God? What's he teaching them? What's he wanting them to learn? What is he showing them? And that thread ties together all of those 10 stories. But there's a second thread. And the second thread is the thread of promise. The God who is this kind of God makes promises. And all through these stories, there's that thread of promise, that this God who makes these promises is a God who keeps his promises. You can count on him. He's true to his promises. There are two major promises that tie together the stories. The first promise is the promise of a seed. The promise to Adam and Eve that they're going to have a baby. The promise to Abraham and Sarah that they're going to have a baby. The promise to Isaac. The promise that through that seed there's going to come a nation, and through that nation there's going to come a blesser. So the promise that God has made of a seed, of an offspring, is a thread that ties together all of those stories. And over again, we will see in our study tomorrow evening, that it will become very important. Moses is teaching this young generation, this kind of God that I'm presenting to you and introducing you to is a God who makes promises. And in spite of all of the odds, in spite of all of the opposition, you can count on him being absolutely trustworthy. He keeps his promises. The first promise is the promise of a seed. The second promise is the promise of a land. He says, I'm going to give you a land. And all through the stories in the rest of the book of Genesis, this idea of a promise of a land and the fulfillment of that promise emerges. And it's Moses' way of saying again to this young generation, listen, if your God makes a promise, he's the kind of God who can pull it off. He's the kind of God you can count on. He'll be absolutely trustworthy and true to that particular promise. And that's what the stories through the rest of the book of Genesis are going to teach us. Now, we're going to look at one of those stories tonight, and each evening during the rest of the week in the goodwill of God, we'll be taking a different story. And our purpose in looking at these stories is to find out the kind of God that's represented in these stories, and then the kind of promises that this God makes, and what he does with those promises, so that this young emerging generation are going to be sold on the fact that their God is God. And when their God said that he was going to give them that land and bring them into that land, in spite of the Jordan River, in spite of the walls of Jericho, in spite of the armies of Canaanites, in spite of the weakness of the Israelitish army, in spite of all of those odds, you can count on him, he'll do it. That's the kind of God he is. And so over and over again, chapter after chapter, verse after verse, Moses is saying to this young generation, when opportunity knocks, when you stand at the edge of that opportunity, when that great challenge is presented to you to take that step, remember your God and remember what he's done in the past. You can absolutely count on him. Go for it. And if you go for it, you'll be blessed. Well, turn with me in the Bible, please, to Genesis chapter 12. And we're going to discover that that's the focus and the emphasis in Genesis chapter 12. It's with this chapter that we're introduced to the story of Abraham. And I'm so happy that Bev has introduced us to some of the emphases that come from the story of Noah, because we're not going to be looking at Noah's story, but Noah's story does the very same kinds of things that the other stories do, and obviously has done those very things for Bev in her own personal life. Now, in Genesis chapter 12, we begin the story of Abraham. The chapter has three movements in it. In the first three verses, you have God's call to Abraham. And then from verse 4 down to verse 9, you have Abraham's response of faith, his obedience of faith. And then from verse 10 to the end of the chapter, you have Abraham's unbelief. So you've got the response of faith and the response of unbelief. Now just let me remind you how I want you to think. When you look at this story, you're saying to yourself, why does Moses tell this story? What does Moses want this young generation of emerging adults to learn? What's the point of the story? And you keep that question constantly in mind as we go through the three movements, and you will discover what Moses wanted them to discover, and it can make the same difference in our life as it made in their life thousands of years ago. Verses 1, 2, and 3, God's call to Abraham. There are two things that God directs Abraham to do. I know that because in the Hebrew text there are two imperatives. There are two commands that are given to Abraham. With each of the commands, there are three promises. Now, that doesn't surprise us. That's the pattern, you see. God gives a command, and he makes a promise. That's exactly what this generation needs to understand. There's going to come a day when God is going to say, go for it. That's your land. I've given it to you. Go for it. And if you go for it, I'll give it to you. Moses tells us, God speaks to Abraham in that same pattern. He gives him a command, three promises. He gives him a second command, three promises. Let me read it to you. Verse 1, now the Lord said to Abram, command number 1, go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I will show you. Promise number 1, and I will make you a great nation. Promise number 2, and I will bless you. Promise number 3, and I will make your name great. Now, our English translations are generally not helpful in this next line. This is an imperative in the Hebrew text. It says, in my translation, and so you shall be a blessing. That is a command to Abraham. He is directed to be a blessing. That is his second imperative. Be a blessing, Abraham. And then follows command, promise number 1, I will bless those who bless you. Promise number 2, the one who curses you, I will curse. Promise number 3, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. I learn some very important basic things about the life of faith in God's call to Abraham. The first thing I learn is that at the heart of God's call to his people in any age and in every age is the call to a life of faith. When God gave these two imperatives to Abraham, he was calling him to a lifestyle of faith. That was at the heart of his call. He was told what to leave, but he was never told where to go. There was a lot of mystery involved with what was given to him in his call. He was directed to leave in the golden years of Ur of the Chaldees, commercially, industrially, financially, educationally, and culturally. Ur was the capital of the world. It was its golden years. And in the midst of all of that incredible experience of Abraham, God comes to him and he says, Abraham, I want you to pick up stock. I want you to pull up your stakes. I want you to leave. Abraham's an older man. He ought to be looking for condominiums on the shore of the Mediterranean. I mean, this is the time to sort of settle down and enjoy all that you've worked for. Right in the midst of it, God comes and he calls him to take a gigantic step of faith. Ladies and gentlemen, you can never, ever be reminded enough that when God called you to be among his people, the heart of that call, the essence of that call, was to a life of faith. Now, I'm a little embarrassed to admit to you that I never quite understood that as I was a young person growing up. somehow I got the idea that the life of faith was reserved for missionaries who went to Africa. Or maybe reserved for some itinerant preachers who didn't have any salary who traveled around Canada. It was a little bit of a shocking experience when God taught me that I was called to a life of faith. That businessmen who are Christians are to live lives of faith. That school teachers, that nurses, that homemakers who are believers are called to a life of faith. At the very heart of your call to be among the people of God is the call to a life of faith. As ye have received Christ Jesus the Lord, so walk ye in him, says Paul to the Colossians. How did you receive him? Friend, that's how you're to walk in him. That's the point. The just shall live how? The just shall live by faith. It's a wonderful gospel text in the book of Hebrews, but the other three times it occurs in the Bible, it's not a gospel text, it's a text for the people of God. The just shall live by faith. We've been called to a life of faith. That's God's calling. That's to be the distinctive of us. Now, of course, when God called Israel to be his people, at the heart of God's call to the nation of Israel was the call to a life of faith. In their brief experience, never, never had they realized that more obviously than when they came to Kadesh Barnea, and there was the land of Canaan in front of them, there was the clear word from God behind them, and he said, I want you to go in, and I want you to take it, and I promise you I'll give it to you. You know from our study last evening, they couldn't trust God. And in unbelief, they turned back, moved out into the wilderness again. Their call to be God's people and to be a people of faith was tested in that operation, in that marvelous opportunity at that strategic time. That's why Moses is writing as he's writing to this generation, because they're going to be the next people who are going to stand in that very spot, and Moses wants them to understand that just as their ancestor Abraham was called to a life of faith, so they, as the people of Israel, have been called to be a people of faith. The first thing I learned then about the life of faith is that it's the very essence of the call of God to his people. It's the very heart of being among the people of God. We're called to a life of faith. The second thing I learned about the life of faith from the call is that sometimes the life of faith, while it normally is a casual walking through life with our hand in the hand of God, just trusting him and depending upon him to guide us and to provide for us and to protect us, but sometimes that average, common, ordinary walk is punctuated. It's sometimes interrupted with a directive from God to take a giant leap. It's sometimes interrupted by a directive from God that is so ridiculous and so risky that the only reason a person would ever do it is because God has told them and they've got to know that God. See, the life of faith is at the very heart of God's call to his people. Secondly, the life of faith is sometimes involving steps that, well, can I use the phrase? Steps that have an apparent ridiculousness to them. Steps that are absolutely radically risky. That's what's true in Abraham's call. He's asked to do something that has all kinds of risk. Something that to other people is going to sound very, very ridiculous. But ladies and gentlemen, that's always been true of men and women who have lived a life of faith. Sooner or later, somewhere along the line, God knocks, opportunity appears, and the challenge is to take a step that is so risky that if God doesn't handle it, There is nothing but disaster that's down the road. When was the last time you took a step like that? See, that's my question to you tonight. When was the last time you took a step like that? Just take a quiet saunter through Hebrews chapter 11. You will discover that every man and woman who made it into that hall of fame for heroes of faith had something absolutely ridiculous about their lifestyle. Abel offered a bloody sacrifice. Cain, a beautiful, attractive fruit sacrifice. Noah built a boat out in the middle of a desert where there's no water. Ridiculous. Abraham leaves. Doesn't know where he's going. Sarah is sitting in a rocking chair on her veranda, knitting baby booties. Good night, Sarah. Pregnant? Really? See, every story is like that. Gideon, left with 300. David picks up a few pebbles to take on Goliath. Every story in Hebrews chapter 11 has ridiculous written all over it. That's the life of faith. Somewhere along the line, sooner or later, the opportunity is going to come, the knock will be there, and God is going to ask you to take a step that is so ridiculous and is so risky that if He doesn't take care of you, then there's nothing but failure and disaster ahead. A few years ago, more than a few years ago now, Marilyn and I and our young 8-year-old son, Mark, at that time went up to Camp Minioi to speak at the college and career camp. On the campgrounds is a nice big hill where they teach mountain climbing, or really mountain rappelling. First day of college and career camp, Brian, the camp director, said, if you want to do some mountain rappelling after lunch, over to the cliff. Mark and Marilyn and I walked over to the cliff. Stood at the foot of it, looked up, it's about 60 feet high. We thought, piece of cake. Walked on a little path around, came up to the top, stood with a bunch of the college and career kids. Brian looked at the gang and said, okay, who will be the first volunteer? Can you guess whose hand went up first? No, it wasn't mine. Mark throws up his hand. Brian says, all right, Mark, come on over here. He puts his back to the cliff, takes a rope and puts it around his waist and buckles that rope around the tree. Takes a second rope, puts it around his armpits, wraps it around his hands. Brian squares his knee just a little bit, looks eyeball to eyeball to Mark, and he says, okay, Mark, back up. And Mark starts backing up. His heels come to the edge of the cliff, then he looked down. He concluded 60 feet down was a lot further than 60 feet up. Mark began to cry. He doesn't like me to tell that now, so if you see him, don't tell him I told you. But Mark began to cry. Mom and Dad seriously considered it, too. Brian looked at Mark, and he said, Mark, there is absolutely no possibility of you falling. Take a look at this rope. Look at that tree. Here's the safety rope. Mark, there is absolutely no possibility of you falling. Now just lean back. And Mark leaned back. In a few moments, he was like this. Walked down the cliff, right to the bottom. I sighed a sigh of relief. And then I realized I had just seen, witnessed what it really meant to risk taking God at His word and stepping off the edge of a cliff because He's the one who tells you to do it and He's the one that's holding the rope. See, that's the life of faith. That's what Abraham does. That's what he's called to do, at least. It's to do that, take that risky step. The third thing I think learn about the life of faith from the call of God to Abraham is that, well, I have to use my imagination here, but you'll allow me to do that, won't you? Sometimes it's misunderstood by other people. Now, my imagination here is the going away, bring your own steak party for Abraham and Sarah the night before they leave, all right? We're in the cul-de-sac where they live, and so there's a going away barbecue party. And so they've all come, they brought their own ginger ale, and they brought their own steaks, and they're having their barbecue. And I can't you imagine the next door neighbor come in and say, "Abraham, it's tomorrow you're leaving, is it?" "Yeah." Where are you heading?" Well, one after another, when the party's over, they're all going home, and they're saying, "Too bad about Abraham, isn't it?" See, can you imagine anybody understanding what he's doing? One of the realities of a man or woman of faith stepping off the edge of a cliff and going for it because God tells them to go for it is that people who don't know God, people who don't understand God, can never understand that. That's one of the hurtful things for people who take steps like that. It's not quite so hurtful when it's a non-Christian who doesn't understand. But it tears the heart out when it's a Christian mom or Christian dad who doesn't understand. When it's a Christian business friend who doesn't understand. It tears the heart out. But that's involved in a life of faith, taking those kinds of steps. I remember when Marilyn and I decided that we were going to leave school teaching and go into full-time Christian ministry up in the Ottawa Valley. I went to the supervising principal of the three schools in our particular small town, and I told him that we'd be resigning, both of us, at the end of the school year, and we were going to go out into Christian ministry. Well, he asked a few questions, and eventually got around to money, and asked, you know, what was going on, and so I sort of explained to him how it was all going to function, or how I hoped it was going to function, and sort of told him a little bit about it. I'll never forget his response. He's a man I respected and a person who was a friend. He put his two elbows on the desk, cupped his hands, dropped his chin into his hands, looked across the desk at me and said, "Bill, I don't understand you." I want you to know that hurt. I sort of expected a pat in the back. "Bill, I don't understand you." But that's always to be expected when men and women undertake the ridiculous. People who don't understand God and who don't know God can't be expected to understand. Well, how is Abraham going to respond? Well, when you come into verses 4 through 9, you get the response of Abraham. And this marvelous paragraph tells us that what he did was exactly the two things that he was commanded to do. Verse 4 begins, "So Abraham went forth." Remember, that was the first imperative. That was his first directive. So he went forth and he did it. Now, what was the second command? What was his second imperative? His second imperative was to be a blessing. Now, let me read the verses and point out to you how he was a blessing. It says, "So Abraham went forth as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. Now Abram was 75 years old when he departed to Haran. Abraham took Sarai his wife, Lot his nephew, and all their possessions which they had accumulated, and the persons which they had acquired in Haran." Now Casuto, who is a Hebrew Christian scholar, says that phrase, "the persons which they had acquired," refers to the persons who had become proselytes under the testimony or under the witness or under the preaching of Abraham. He's made a long journey and he has acquired some people. It's a Hebrew colloquialism. He has acquired some people. People who have become the worshipers of his God through his witness and testimony. You see, he has become a blessing. The text continues in the middle of verse 5. "And they set out for the land of Canaan. Thus they came to the land of Canaan. So Abram passed through the land as far as the site of Shechem to the oak of Moreh." Now the Canaanite was then in the land. Skip down to verse 8. "Then he proceeded from there to the mountain in the east of Bethel, pitched his tent with Bethel on the west, Ai on the east. There he built an altar to the Lord and called upon the name of the Lord." Literally, that phrase means he made proclamation of the Lord by name. Martin Luther, in his translation, the German translation, says he preached the name of the Lord. Get the picture. Every place Abraham goes, he builds an altar and he has a little mini series on the attributes of God. He preaches the name of the Lord, the character of the Lord, the attributes of the Lord. He preaches about the Lord. People respond and they become the worshipers of that Lord. What I'm saying to you is, Abraham obeys the two imperatives that are given to him. Get out, he gets out. Be a blessing, he's a blessing. Abraham obeys. That's, ladies and gentlemen, the fourth thing that you can always understand about a life of faith. A life of faith is evidenced by the lifestyle of obedience. It's not evidenced by how loudly we sing our songs and choruses about trusting God. I tell you, that's easy. Have a closing hymn at the end of the service and talk about trusting God. That's a piece of cake, especially at Guelph conference grounds. The evidence is that you're so prepared to trust him that when he says to take a step off the edge of a cliff, I'm going to hold on to the rope. I'll look after you. I'll care for your children. I'll look after that business. When he says to take a step off the edge of the cliff, you say, I'm ready, Lord. I can trust you with my life. I can trust you with my career. I can trust you with my marriage. I can trust you with my health. I'm ready. That, ladies and gentlemen, is the evidence of faith. It's a lifestyle of obedience. One of our national news magazines told a wonderful story a few years ago. Told the story of a young blind girl who was trapped in her fourth floor apartment in the Bronx when the apartment building caught on fire one day. The fire trucks appeared on the scene, and you can imagine exactly their procedure. The net was brought out. The fire chief took the blowhorn. He stood in the middle of the street. He called up to this blind girl who was at that window with smoke around her, with the flames around her, with the heat around her, and he pleaded with the young girl to jump. He said, we'll catch you. You just jump, we'll catch you. Well, of course, couldn't expect a blind girl to do that, could you? And she couldn't bring herself to jump. A very alert police officer found her daddy at work. The cruiser appeared with the lights flashing and the sirens going. Daddy jumped out of the back seat, ran to the fire chief, pulled the blowhorn from his hand, directed it toward his blind daughter, calling her by name, saying, honey, jump, I'll catch you. She jumped. She jumped. Time magazine concluded the story by saying she jumped from the fourth floor into the net without breaking a bone. She was so relaxed in the fall. See, I say to you, that's what a young blind girl would dare to do when she hears the voice of her daddy, who she's come to know and trust. That's precisely Abraham's response. My question to you this evening, when was the last time you jumped blind out of a window because God said, go for it? I'll catch you. Go for it. You see, one of the great, great tragedies of the latter part of the 20th century, ladies and gentlemen, is that most of the men and women that are here in this audience this evening have chosen to live life safely. I feel sorry for the young people that I have to deal with in our Bible college and seminary. They don't have many good models of elders in their churches, of pastors, of parents. They don't have many good models of mums and dads who have been prepared to step off the edge of a cliff, who've been ready to jump out of a window, who've been really prepared to model a lifestyle of obedience because they've got to know God and they're ready to trust him. That's Abraham. It's the fourth thing about a life of faith. It's evidenced by a lifestyle of obedience. How do you explain it? Well, I think the fifth thing that we can assume is that this kind of faith is rooted in a knowledge of God. It's in the kind of God that Abraham has got to know. Now, I wish I knew more about Terah. I really do. I'd like to know what Terah had taught his son Abraham. I'd like to know about the family devotions they'd had in their home. I'd like to know about what had happened in Abraham's life prior to chapter 12. It isn't just out of no prehistory that Abraham does this at 75 years of age. Something's been happening so that when the opportunity comes, when God says, jump! When he says, take that step! Abraham so knows God that he's willing to step out and do it. You'll find it's always true. A life of faith, evidenced in a lifestyle of obedience, is always rooted in a knowledge of God and in a relationship with God. Right in the midst of the passage, there's the consequence, there's the result from it. I skipped over verse 7 purposefully. Let me read it to you now. It says, right in the midst of this situation, the Lord appeared to Abraham and said, to your descendants, I will give this land. So he built an altar there to the Lord who had appeared to him. The sixth thing about a life of faith is that it opens the door to the greatest blessings, the greatest joys, and the greatest rewards of life. What if Abraham hadn't jumped? What if Abraham had played it safe? Well, those hypothetical things we can't respond to. But what we can say is that, hey, listen, you young Israelites, listen, you young emerging adults, listen, you young families, let me tell you about Grandpa Abraham. When God told him to go for it, he went for it. And God gave him the land. The message is as clear as it could be. When God tells you go for it, go for it, and God will give you the land. That's what he wants them to understand. And I say to you, good friends, this evening, when God tells you to go for it, a new career, a new relationship, a new ministry, a new move, when God tells you to go for it, go for it. And it'll open up the greatest blessings and the greatest rewards that you will ever experience in your life. That's the second movement. I quickly conclude with the third movement. It starts at verse 10 down to the end of the chapter. It's a bit of a sordid story, and I'm going to read it through for you, and I'm going to be asking you to ask yourself all the time I read it through to you, why does Moses tell this story? What's the lesson he wants this young generation to learn? Now there was a famine in the land, so Abraham went down to Egypt. That has all kinds of overtones for this young emerging generation, right? There was a famine in the land. Jacob and the whole family went down into Egypt. So there was a famine in the land. Abraham went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land. It came about when he came near to Egypt that he said to Sarai's wife, see now, I know that you are a beautiful woman. That word beautiful does not necessarily mean physically or sexually attractive. She is an elderly woman. The word that's used there is a word that means you're a regal woman. I've known some ladies who are elderly that carry themselves like the queen mother. That's the kind of woman Sarah was. She was a regal woman. She carried herself with dignity. That's the kind of woman she is. Verse 12 says, and it will come about when the Egyptians see you that they will say, this is his wife. They will kill me. They'll let you live. Please say that you are my sister, so that it may go well with me because of you, and that I may live on account of you. She, of course, was his half-sister, so it's really a half-lie that he's proposing. And it came about when Abram came to Egypt, the Egyptians saw that the woman was very regal. Pharaoh's official said to her, saw her and praised her to Pharaoh. The woman was taken into Pharaoh's house to become part of his wives. Therefore he treated Abram well for her sake, and gave him sheep and oxen and donkeys and male female servants and female donkeys and camels. But the Lord struck Pharaoh and his house with great plagues. Oh, isn't that interesting? Because of Sarai, Abram's wife. When Pharaoh called Abram, said, "What is this that you've done to me? Why did you not tell me that she was your wife? Why did you say she is my sister, so that I took her for my wife? Now then, here is your wife, take her and go." And Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they escorted him away with his wife and all that belonged to him. And so Abram went up from Egypt to the Negev, that is the southern part of the land of Canaan. Why does Abraham tell the story? Two reasons. Reason number one, to encourage this young emerging generation. Did you catch the remarkable parallelism between Abraham and Sarah in this story and Jacob and the children of Israel coming down through Joseph and on to Moses? The parallel is striking. Abraham has a famine in his land. Jacob and his family have a famine in the land. Abraham leaves the land and comes down to Egypt. Jacob, Joseph, and all of the clan come down to Egypt. When they come down to Egypt, Abraham spoils the Egyptians. He becomes wealthy at their expense. When Joseph and his family come down to Egypt, they spoil the Egyptians. They become wealthy at the expense of the Egyptians. There's a proposed scheme that threatens the life of the male, keeping the female alive. There is a proposed and implemented scheme that threatened the lives of males, Moses' life, and kept the females alive. God sends plagues upon the house of Pharaoh. God sends plagues upon Pharaoh and the Egyptians. God delivers Abraham and directs Pharaoh to exit Abraham and his family from Egypt. And Pharaoh directs Moses and Aaron and all of the nation to get out of the land and to head back to the land. And then the concluding sentence, God takes them out of the land of Egypt and brings them right back into the land of Canaan. The only unanswered aspect into the whole parallelism is that very last line, and the story is told so that Moses can say to them, just exactly as God did all of this for Abraham under circumstances that were exactly similar to yours, and he took Abraham out of Egypt and put him right back in the land. Listen, you young people, listen, you young adults, listen, you young moms and dads who are raising your children and are moving in this direction, you can count on it, God is going to do that for you too. The story is told to encourage them so that they'll trust God. So that when they come to the end of the land, edge of the land, and there's the opportunity, they'll be able to say, remember what God did for Abraham? He brought him right back into the land, and that's what God has promised to do for us. He did it for Abraham, he'll do it for us. It's designed to encourage them to trust God. And I say to you, it's exactly what it's designed to do for us. To encourage us to trust him. The second reason why the story is told is to warn. It's to warn. Because what Abraham does is really an act of unbelief. He's not ready to trust God to look after his life. He knows his wife's life is okay, but he's a little concerned about his life. And so he designs and concocts a scheme that's a partial truth wrapped around a lie. And he does it to save his skin. It's a little act of unbelief. Now notice this carefully, because this is the key. It's a little act of unbelief that was really rooted in fear. He was afraid. And the reason why he was afraid was that he wasn't prepared to trust God and to step out and really be obedient to God as he goes to Egypt. With that act of fear rooted in unbelief,
What Abraham does is jeopardize the whole plan and the whole purposes of God. Moses has a very important lesson to teach this young generation. His lesson is fear that's rooted in unbelief always has a way of immobilizing us and neutralizing us in the lifestyle of trusting and obeying. And when that happens, we jeopardize, if I can use that phrase, we jeopardize the plans and the purposes of God and threaten to forfeit God's blessing that He has in store for us. It's a very solemn lesson. The fact of the matter is that many of us struggle with obeying God because we're afraid. And when we're afraid, over and over again, an honest assessment will indicate that that fear is really rooted in unbelief. I'm not sure I can trust God with my kids to look after us. I'm not sure I can trust God to provide the money. I'm not sure that I can trust God to protect me. Fear that's rooted in unbelief immobilizes us, neutralizes us, robs us of the blessing that's promised to us with a lifestyle of trusting Him and obeying Him. I'd like to ask you very candidly tonight, is it possible that right where you are, right at this stage of your life, that you're scared to death to take that move, to take that job, to take that ministry, to accept that responsibility? You're scared to death. And that fear, really, honestly, is rooted in the fact that you're not prepared to really trust God. If that's where you are tonight, I've got something to say to you. If you're not there tonight, my guess is you'll be there sometime during this year. I've got something to say to you. Fear that's rooted in unbelief is never a good enough reason for not doing it. It is never a good enough reason for not going. It is never a good enough reason for not obeying. Fear that's rooted in unbelief will rob you of the greatest joys and the greatest blessings in life. I say to you, the story of Abraham in Genesis chapter 12 has taken on a whole new meaning to me, a whole new significance, because it addresses how I approach my ministry, it addresses how I raise my children, it addresses the major decisions that I make in life, it addresses how I deal with fears and insecurities and uncertainties. It addresses what I do when I come to the edge of a mountain, right to the edge of a cliff, and God says, "Hey, Bill, go for it. I got a hold of the ropes. There's no possibility of falling. Take a step. Step right off that cliff. I know people won't understand. I know it sounds ridiculous, but go for it. Take a jump. Jump out of that window. I know you can't see. I know you don't know where the net is, but don't you hear my voice? That's me calling you. It's your Father. You've got to know me. You can trust me. Take a jump. I'll care for you." Friend, it's that kind of lifestyle that opens up the greatest joys and the greatest blessings of life. When Moody was having his great evangelistic services, D.B. Towner was sometimes his song leader. What Towner liked to do occasionally was to open it up for words of testimony from people in the audience. On one occasion, he asked if anyone would like to give a word of testimony, and a young man stood up halfway down the audience over here. He said something like this. He said, "I have not been a Christian very long. I don't know much about the Bible, but one thing I've decided to do, and that is to trust God and to obey Him." Well, Towner thought, that sounds pretty good. Short time later, he was talking to Reverend Sammis, a Presbyterian minister. He told him that story. Sammis, an eccentric fellow with a little bit of a goatee, got quite excited, jumped to his feet, and turned to his friend, and he said, "Why, Towner, that is the very essence of the Christian life." And Sammis went home and wrote the words to to a song that's become one of my very, very favorite songs. Probably one of the reasons is because when I was a teenager, baptized in our chapel back home in Toronto, when I come up out of the waters of baptism, that's what the congregation was singing. I can still hear them sing it. It stuck with me all through my life. When we walk with the Lord in the light of His Word, what a glory He sheds on our way. While we do His good will, He abides with us still and with all who will trust and obey. Trust and obey. There's no other way. Abraham, Israel, Christian, there is no other way to be happy in Jesus but to trust and obey. A few years later, Reverend Samus was preaching on the West Coast. The young song leader thought he would honor the hymn writer and sing the hymn just before he called Samus to preach. Time was going, and so the song leader said, "We'll sing verses 1, 2, and 4. Now, you never do that when the hymn writer's in the audience. Okay? Samus was sitting over here. He leaped to his feet, charged the pulpit, took the microphone from the hand of the young song leader, and he said, "Don't miss verse 3. That's really why I wrote the hymn." But we never can prove the delights of His love until all on the altar is laid. For the favor He shows and the joy He bestows are for them who will trust and obey. Will you? Trust and obey. There's absolutely no other way to really be happy in Jesus.